Welcome to The Modern Scholar, where great professors teach you. My name is Brian Keeler, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled The Law of the Land, A History of the Supreme Court. Your professor is Kermit Hall, president of Utah State University and professor of history. Professor Hall earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Akron and his Ph.D. from the University of Minnesota. He holds an MSL from Yale Law School. President Hall has published widely in the fields of American constitutional and legal history, including works entitled The Politics of Justice, Federal Judicial Selection in the Second American Party System, and The Magic Mirror, Law in American History. He has also edited and co-edited some 17 other works, including The Oxford Guide to Supreme Court Decisions. In 1999, the American Library Association bestowed the James Madison Award on him for his service on the five-member John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Review Board, to which he was appointed by President Bill Clinton and confirmed by the United States Senate. Of the three branches of the U.S. government, the Supreme Court is perhaps the least understood. Unlike the elected legislative and executive branches, the justices of the Supreme Court are appointed and therefore enjoy a degree of independence from the direct winds of politics. Moreover, while the cases that come before them are always heard in public, they are always decided in private, in conferences that the justices alone attend. What transpires in both the open court and behind closed doors? What is the decision-making process, and what considerations are taken into account? To what degree do tradition, politics, and precedent play a role in how the justices act? What decisions have impacted this nation and our daily lives the most? These are some of the questions we'll address in this course, as we explore the history of this most mysterious of government institutions. In the end, we'll arrive at a better understanding of the High Court, its justices, its traditions, and most importantly, its decisions which have impacted the American Republic over the previous two centuries and continue to do so today. While you will certainly learn a great deal by listening to Professor Hall's lectures, you'll get the most out of this course if you pursue the additional studies outlined in the accompanying course guide. Here you'll find recommended readings, illustrations, and short essays. In addition, by visiting this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, you'll have access to the most up-to-date information about this course, including links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin The Law of the Land, A History of the U.S. Supreme Court. Lecture 1. The Judicial Power, Jurisdiction, and the Ages of the Supreme Court. And now, Professor Hall.
Well, welcome to this first lecture in what is a series of lectures about the history of the Supreme Court of the United States. Few institutions, I would remind you, are more fascinating. Few institutions are less understood. And few institutions play as dynamic and important a role in the life of all Americans as does the Supreme Court. Now, the purpose of this particular lecture, the first in a series of 14, is to introduce the essential features of the Supreme Court of the United States. This lecture was going to give specific and particular attention to the role of the court in the context of the Constitution. We'll talk a little bit about jurisdiction. We'll talk a little bit about its composition and operation. I'm going to mention several of its justices, some who've done quite well and others who, well, didn't do well at all. And we'll also talk about the major phases of the development of the court over the past two centuries. And I want to stress this point particularly to you. Think of the Supreme Court as a mirror that reflects back the changing assumptions and the culture of American society. And if you think of it in that way, then you realize that one of the most important roles that the Supreme Court does is to adapt and change to the circumstances that are presented to it. Now, not everyone believes, of course, that the High Court should, in fact, adapt the Constitution. Some would argue that it should exercise absolute fidelity to the original meaning of the framers. Others, however, suggest that one of the critical roles that the court plays is that it does, in fact, take the Constitution and take the set of circumstances that are presented to it and adjust those to fit the needs of the time. We're going to pursue the history of the court through what its principal means of expression to the American people is. And those are the cases that the court decides. We're going to examine 13 of the most important cases ever decided by the High Court. Now, some may think that others should take the place or one of two, one or more of these, but I would submit to you that as we work our way through each of these cases, you'll see the way in which this magic mirror of the court reflects back the changing assumptions about the nature of the Constitution, the nature of American politics, and the character of American society. And when I get to the end of the lecture today, I'll also suggest to you a couple of works that I think would be especially helpful in drawing some broader understanding. First, though, let's see if we can turn our attention to the court itself. It is at once the most accessible and the least accessible branch of government. Unlike the executive and legislative branches, the Supreme Court of the United States has to explain what it does. And it does so through its writings, and those writings appear in decisions. Since the court's founding back in 1789, it's delivered enough opinions to fill more than 500 volumes of the official reporter of the court's decisions, that's United States Reports. And as of 2001, there were 110 justices who had sat on the High Court. Now, the justices, we need to remember, reached their decision through a process that involves very open argument in court by parties who are in an adversarial relationship. That session in court provides the justices the opportunity to raise questions before the counsel that are appearing in the court. And, of course, what goes on in the court is reported in the media on a very regular basis. In fact, few persons who argue before the Supreme Court, lawyers that is, ever really complete their arguments because the justices take a highly interventionist role. Yet the court is also among the least open, in some ways the least accessible of the branches of the American government. The justices, once they hear a case, then go back into what's called a conference. And no one is permitted in the conference except the justices themselves. Now, these conferences have been going on, again, for more than 200 years. They've changed in character over time. John Marshall did them a little more informally and with a little more depth than is apparently done today. We don't know for sure exactly what happens. Some of the justices have left notes and diaries behind that indicate some of what has occurred in the conferences. We do know that increasingly the conferences have become somewhat more formal as opposed to informal discussions. Even the justices' clerks, and the clerks, by the way, have been around since the mid-1870s, even the justices' clerks are excused from these meetings. The Chief Justice presides over the meetings of the conference. He's the person in the end who makes the decisions about who will end up writing the opinions, the opinion for the court. Now, the justices, it's important to remember this kind of, on the one hand, very accessible and at the same time inaccessible group. The justices have, under our constitutional system, been purposely insulated from direct political pressure. Indeed, the founders of the American government back in Philadelphia recognized that one of the most important features of the judiciary would be its independence from direct political pressure. That doesn't mean the justices don't get involved in politics, because their decisions often have extraordinary political consequences. But it does mean that, by and large, they're put in the position where, in deciding cases, they don't feel immediate pressure. Well, why is that so? I mean, how does that work? Well, First, it's important to understand that they serve during good behavior. Some people like to say they serve during life tenure, but in point of fact, that's not correct. They serve during good behavior. Can a justice of the Supreme Court be removed? Yes, a justice can be impeached by an action of the House of Representatives, and a justice can be convicted by a vote of the Senate. That's, of course, never happened. We have had a justice impeached, Samuel Chase, back in 1805, but no one has ever been removed from the high court by act of impeachment followed by conviction for what are called high crimes and misdemeanors. The justices are appointed, of course, by the president, but that appointment has to have the advice and consent of the Senate. What it means is the justices don't stand for election and they don't stand for re-election, so they aren't directly put in the way of political pressure. Moreover, the Constitution provides that the justices' salaries cannot be diminished while they are in office. They keep their pay no matter what they do, and if you think about it, that really is not too bad a job to have. Tenure during good behavior and you're guaranteed your salary. The decision about whether they stay on the bench in the end, though, is really theirs. There have been many instances, in fact, where justices such as William O. Douglas have probably stayed on a little bit longer than they should have. Yet often, as it turns out, what the justices write in their opinions tends to be framed in ways that are legal and pose and draw from the Constitution. And that makes it hard oftentimes for all of us to understand exactly what the justices are trying to say. And one of our objectives with this course is, in fact, to give each of you a sense of what's really important in what the court does, as opposed to just the technical features of its actions. Well, let's turn our attention to the distinctly American character of this Supreme Court. Back in the 1830s, Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a French social critic and pioneer, really, in penal reform in France, came to the United States to examine the new nation. He wrote a two-volume work, really one of the most influential in the history of the nation, and one very much worth taking account of when thinking about the High Court. Among Tocqueville's most impressive insights was his reconnaissance about the nature of the judiciary and the Supreme Court in particular. He noted that even then, back in the early 1830s, that, according and using his words, "I'm unaware that any nation on the globe has hitherto organized a judicial power in the same manner as the Americans. A more imposing judicial power was never constituted by a people." What Tocqueville meant, of course, was that Americans, in framing the Supreme Court in Article III of the Constitution, intended to create an opportunity on the one hand for issues to be decided lawfully and at the same time for those issues to be placed in a context in which constitutional debate would help to frame political outcomes. Now, in more recent times, the courts have been viewed in about the same way. Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes, who served during the 1930s, and by the way, Chief Justice Hughes is the only person in the history of the Supreme Court to have been an associate justice, left the bench, and then came back to be a chief justice. He ran for the presidency and ended up being defeated by Woodrow Wilson. In any event, Chief Justice Hughes noted that the Supreme Court was distinctly American in conception and function. And in fact, what drew Hughes's attention, what drew the attention of Tocqueville, what draws the attention of all observers of the court is the power of the justices to review the acts of other branches of government. And if they feel compelled for constitutional reasons to reverse what those other branches have done. Now, only a few other courts in the world have powers of the same scope and the same operation, and indeed, for most of the modern world, the American Supreme Court, at least on the question of judicial review, and something we're going to talk about a little bit later on, this ability to review the acts of other branches, the process of judicial review is really viewed as one of the distinctive characteristics of the High Court. But the history of the court also reminds us that it has its powers have not always been what they have come to be today. And indeed, one of the purposes of this course and of these lectures is to remind each of you that there has been a profound and significant transformation in the way in which the court functions within the American constitutional order. Now, let's take a look at the Constitution. Let's go inside of it and find out exactly where this Supreme Court fits and a little bit about where it came from. The Supreme Court is, in fact, a creature of what happened in Philadelphia between May and September of 1787, when those delegates to the Constitutional Convention sat down, and I remind you, sat down in secret, and tried to fashion a governing document for the new American nation. Among the reasons that the delegates gathered at Philadelphia, and in many ways one of the most important, was their concern that under the existing Articles of Confederation, the rule of law, the idea that no person should be above the law, was in fact in serious threat. They were also concerned about another issue, and the other issue was that the states, as they saw it under the Articles of Confederation, were in fact gaining too much power. Now, when the Americans look for an example of a judiciary, what they turned to was the experience they'd had with the English Empire. The American colonials actually had little immediate control over the matters of empire that were taken back to London and there judged by what was called the Privy Council, kind of a bureaucratic administrative group, if you will, that operated within Parliament and within the administration of the Crown. The Americans came to learn, of course, that having their laws subjected to comment by the English put them in the position of not being able to control their legal destinies. But the Revolutionary era also taught the Americans something else, and very, very profound. It taught them that If law was subjected or subverted by political instinct, then it was no law at all. We need to remember as well that the folks who fought this revolution and eventually found their way to Philadelphia had a very critical problem. And their problem was how, on the one hand, to break the law while remaining legal. And the solution to that, of course, was first propounded in the Declaration of Independence. Then it found expression in the Articles of Confederation. But there was an underlying assumption that in America, as opposed to the empire, principles of right and justice should prevail at every turn. And what that meant is that the revolutionaries intended to create a governmental order that rested on two important but in some ways antagonistic beliefs. On the one hand, they wanted to create government that would be sensitive to the people. On the other, as they learned so well in the years leading up to the revolution, they wanted a government that would rest on law and administer it. Now, the Articles of Confederation, of course, that went into effect in 1783, had really no national judiciary. There were some judges that took care of matters involving what are called admiralty and maritime, but most of the work of the law was carried out by states and by state courts. And if you keep that in mind as we move along here, you'll begin to understand why so many of the people in the states were very concerned about the growing power of the Supreme Court. The framers of the Constitution, of course, were the strongest, were advocates of a Supreme Court, but they were actually quite divided in Philadelphia about how quite to develop it. And what they settled on was a scheme of an independent judiciary, one that would have a Supreme Court, but that left most of the powers of that court to be decided upon by Congress. The leading proponents in the convention for a Supreme Court and a strong federal judiciary were known as the Federalists. And what they wanted was to create a government that would be held to a standard of national law, and one of which would be able to restrain the states and also to restrain popular will. Now, the judiciary and the Supreme Court itself are found in Article 3 of the Constitution. And if you go back and read those debates in Philadelphia, while there was a good deal of thought that went into the Supreme Court, it's surprising how little time it took the delegates really to settle on the idea of having one Supreme Court provided for under Article III and then many lower courts that would be framed by Congress. The new Supreme Court was actually given very limited jurisdiction. Its principal jurisdiction is appellate. Well, what does appellate mean? What appellate means is that it hears cases that have already been tried in some other court, perhaps in one of the lower federal courts, most commonly known as district courts, or in courts in the states. Article III did provide that the federal courts in general and the Supreme Court in particular would hear all cases, and these are really the words from Article III, all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties, and to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, and to controversies between two or more states, and between a state and a citizen of another state. Now, the crucial purpose of Article III was not to limit the courts, but to empower them generally and the Supreme Court in particular. So when we think of the Supreme Court, we need to kind of think of it as an empty vessel with a lot of opportunity that was susceptible, if we had the right kind of leadership, to being filled up with an extraordinary degree of power and ultimately influence in government. What happened, of course, is that the court ended up with a very limited original jurisdiction. That original jurisdiction extended principally to cases involving ambassadors and other officials of the American government who were abroad. It's also, though, important to remember we've got Article III, and we have this idea of a Supreme Court, but it needs to be connected with Article VI of the Constitution, and one of the most really critical links to be made. Article VI established that the Constitution was, in the words of Article VI, the supreme law of the land. Now, by inference, since the Supreme Court was the highest court of the land, that meant that the Supreme Court functioned as the ultimate and most important interpreter of what that supreme law of the land was. So, as we proceed through the course, remember this connection between Article III, establishing the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts, and then granting this jurisdiction, and then, on the other hand, Article VI, which made the Constitution the supreme law of the land. Again, the connection between, on the one hand, the idea of law, and then the other, the idea of the court, and then the Constitution as the supreme and final ruling document in law. Now, let's turn our attention a little different way. The Constitution doesn't provide a specific number of justices. In fact, it doesn't really provide much by way of qualification if you wanted to be a justice. Say you're out there and you said, geez, I really would like to do this. What do I have to do to apply? The answer is that the Constitution doesn't require that you be a lawyer. The Constitution, in fact, doesn't even require that you have to be born in the United States. You do have to be a citizen. But the members of the court, in fact, can be foreign-born persons. James Wilson, James Urdell, David J. Brewer, George Sutherland, Felix Frankfurter, for example, were all justices who were born abroad. How many justices should there be? Well, the Constitution doesn't provide. That's left up to Congress to do. And Congress, by the way, did that. Beginning in 1789 through what was known as the Judiciary Act of 1789. Now, there are nine justices today, but that number was the norm only beginning in the 1830s. It's varied a little bit from time to time. During the Civil War, the number of justices was reduced briefly to eight. And at the inception of the court, when it began back there in 1789, the number of justices were six. A number, by the way, that was dictated in good measure because the justices who were originally appointed to the court had to go out and do another job. They had to go out and ride circuit, and it was one of the most loathsome and unhappy jobs that the justices had. And as we're going to see, it ultimately led to a good deal of controversy about the role of the court. The number of justices in 1801 went down to 5 and had something to do with politics, and we're going to talk about that in the next lecture. There have been periods in which circuit riding was abolished and then restored and then abolished again. Today, the justices don't ride circuit, although they do have responsibilities in each of the circuits that are scattered around the United States, of which there are now 11. In 1837, the number of justices went to 9. And that's pretty much the way it's stayed ever since. Now, the court's had several homes throughout its history. Most of you probably think of the Supreme Court and sitting up there right behind the Capitol on Capitol Hill, and it's that building has been there since 1935. It's known as the Marble Palace to some of its friends, and if you've ever been by it, you can appreciate why, since it's made out of glorious, almost luminescent white marble. But actually, the history of the court since its beginning, or at least up till 1935, it shared a lot of different facilities. The first session of the court was held at the Royal Exchange Building in New York City, which was also the home, by the way, of the New York legislature. So much for the independence, I guess, of the Supreme Court. In 1790, the Capitol moved to Philadelphia. The justices moved right along with it. And guess where they ended up? They ended up in City Hall in Philadelphia. Of course, Pierre-Charles L'Enfant designed a space for the court in the new capital city of Washington, D.C., but in fact, L'Enfant's building was never erected, and the justices, when they did move to Washington in 1801, ended up spending their time in an unfurnished chamber in the just-being-built capital of the United States. Subsequently, during the Civil War, the court continued to have its home in the Capitol, and it wasn't until 1935 that it moved to its present building. It's worth remembering, too, that the court in its present home is really the outcome of an extraordinary effort by Chief Justice William Howard Taft. And in fact, Taft, who served as Chief Justice for 10 years, really tried to give the court greater distinction by, in fact, finding a better home for it. The new building, as I mentioned, was constructed of marble, and it is really one of the most magnificent court buildings in all of the United States. The most important part of the business that comes to this building now has been the result, of course, of the appellate jurisdiction of the court. From the outset, Congress really did not give the high court all the power it might exercise, and the history of the court is really an increasing commitment by the Congress to give the court more and more responsibility to fill up its, if you will, its kind of jurisdictional bucket. And the result of that is that over time, Congress has proved more than willing to turn an increasing power over to the court with the view that the court, in fact, might, through its decisions, give Congress some help. Now, the way a case gets to the court, court involves a petition that's made. The way that that petition operates today is that a person who wants the court to hear his case asks the court to issue a writ of certiorari. And what this means is that the court is being asked to go take a case, to hear a case. Today, there are about 500 petitions sent to the Supreme Court for what's called cert. Only a handful of these, probably about 5%, are ever heard by the justices. All the rest are dismissed almost always without any kind of written comment. And when that happens, by the way, the law stands as it is. And if the court doesn't hear a case, the law is exactly the way it was when the court refused to hear it. And that's important to remember because it means even when the Supreme Court doesn't act, doesn't hear a case, doesn't write a decision, it is in fact having and producing an outcome. The modern Supreme Court has much, much more control over its docket than did its predecessors, especially in the 19th century. The Signal Act involving the judiciary in the 20th century was the Judiciary Act of 1925. It effectively gave broad discretion to the Supreme Court to hear whatever cases it wanted to. Between 1791 and 1800, the justices heard about 100 cases. Today, the Supreme Court's docket exceeds more than 6,000 cases. Yet, because the court has this great discretion through the writ of certiorari over its docket, it can pick and choose the cases it wants to hear. And that means that its rulings really end up having a broad potential to shape the way we understand critical issues of public policy. Well, how many cases does the court take? Well, since the 1980s, the court has been taking and hearing and deciding, ultimately, between 85 and 100 cases a year. And actually, over time, that number has been gradually coming down. What the court's able to do with its discretion is it's able and has been able to emerge as a kind of a tribunal of constitutional as opposed to statutory interpretation. The court has increasingly put itself in the position where it decides big questions. It doesn't decide small questions. Now, that having been said, it's also important as we work our way through this course to remember that the Supreme Court is in effect a hybrid institution. On the one hand, it's political, social, and economic, and cultural, as well as legal and constitutional. Again, let's go back to Alexis de Tocqueville, that French visitor who came over. He captured the significance of the court as more than just a legal institution when he observed, in his words, "Scarcely any political question arises in the United States that is not resolved sooner or later into a judicial question." Very powerful words. What this has meant is that the Supreme Court has been in the position over the years of hearing political, social, economic issues dressed up, kind of put in a garb, if you will, of constitutional argument. And the willingness of political figures to take some of the most challenging issues, slavery, abortion, the income tax, and have the court resolve them constitutionally is a signal of why the court has in fact been able to expand its powers. And the cases we're going to examine in this course really get at that relationship, if you will, between what the court does legally and constitutionally and the impact that it has in areas such as gender issues, the place of Native Americans, segregation by race, abortion, the division of powers between state and national government. The court's decisions, then, we need to remember, really reflect the way in which American society operates, the way in which politics is carried into the constitutional arena. Through the 19th century, issues were much different than they were in the 20th century. For example, in the 19th century, the critical issues turned, at least up until the time of the Civil War, about the relationship of the states to the nation. And undergirding these were a whole series of questions about property rights and the way in which the Constitution should protect those rights. Then, in the period after the Civil War, from about 1867 to about 1937, what the court was left to deal with were questions that involved issues growing out of the Industrial Revolution in the United States and massive immigration. In fact, the justices were put in the position of having to kind of deal with a document crafted in the 18th century to deal with the realities of an industrial market economy in the 19th and 20th centuries. And since 1937, what's really been going on is that the court has taken up issues that involve questions of equal protection of the laws, of civil liberties, civil rights, equality as it is expressed in terms of gender and race, but also matters of speech and press and First Amendment. Most of those issues, especially the First Amendment questions, including, by the way, matters involving religion, really were not touched on by the 19th century Supreme Court. Now, the United States Supreme Court, as I think you're going to discover as we work our way through this course, has turned out to be America's ongoing national constitutional convention. You know, there's only been one, and that was in 1787. The Supreme Court has, in fact, filled in that role. And it's filled in that role not just because it has had superior leadership at critical points in its history, but because, in fact, American political leaders, and I would submit to you the American people, have expected it to do exactly that. To adjust and modify the ruling document created in the 18th century to take account of the realities as they have developed over time. You all need to understand, though, as we work our way through these materials, that not everyone believes that that's an appropriate role for the Supreme Court. In hindsight, of course, we know that Alexander Hamilton, in one of the most famous of his writings, Federalist No. 78, described the Supreme Court as the least dangerous branch. And by that, he meant the least dangerous branch to the liberties of Americans. Of course, what's happened over time is that least dangerous branch has emerged as one of the most powerful and influential institutions in American life. The story about how that happened, the story about why the Supreme Court has acceded to this position of authority, and then the related questions about whether this has been good or bad for the American people are really what this course is all about. Now, we're going to examine 13 cases. We're going to follow those cases in some detail and use them really as touchstones, as ways to understand how the Supreme Court operates, who have been its most influential justices, and who have not been so influential. We know some of them, of course, John Marshall, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Earl Warren, Louis Brandeis, William Brennan, Hugo Black, probably William O. Douglas, Felix Frankfurter, Benjamin Cardozo. We're going to touch all of them as we move forward. But I want you, as you listen to each of these lectures, I want you to remember what's happening. The Supreme Court, over the past two centuries, has had to establish three critical principles. One, the institution of judicial review, that is, the ability of the court to declare acts of other branches of government, state or federal, as being in conflict with the Constitution. The second, the concept of judicial independence, that is, the court is free from direct political pressure. It can't be bludgeoned. It can't be bullied. And then third and finally, and perhaps most importantly, the concept of judicial sovereignty. And what this concept of judicial sovereignty means is that the court gets the final word. What it says is what the Constitution means. Now, we're going to find out in a few instances, such as Dred Scott, this really didn't hold true. But nonetheless, the history of the Supreme Court is the history of the development of judicial review, the development of judicial independence, and the development of judicial sovereignty. Now, let me conclude by recommending that you might find it helpful to take a look at Robert G. McCloskey's The American Supreme Court, the revised edition of it, which is really one of the most brilliant and insightful books about the history and development of the court. And the other by Bernard Schwartz, A History of the Supreme Court, which provides an enormous amount of detail and really critical insight about the way in which the courts developed over time. Now, in the next lecture, we're going to take on one of those important concepts, judicial review. And we're going to do so by turning to probably the most important case ever decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, Marbury versus Madison in 1803.
This ends Lecture 1.